Okay, welcome everyone. It's an exciting topic, a new series, hopefully, in Inyanei Kashrus, different contemporary issues in Kashrus. Kashrus is something that we have to all deal with regularly, both in our homes, when we go shopping, and then also when we eat out. Very often we're on the road, we're traveling, we have questions, so this is an important topic in general, and I wanted to start with Starbucks, number one, because it's interesting. It's a fascinating topic. For those of you who remember, I would say probably about 5 years ago or so, 4 or 5 years ago, the issue really blew up. I don't know if you remember this, but it really blew up. Everybody was talking about it, and different kashrus organizations did a lot of research and weighed in on it. People were upset, people were happy, you know, all the rabbis were talking about it. That was about 4 or 5 years ago. So since then, I've done a little bit of research into the topic, and it's a really fascinating topic. Starbucks is something that many of us grow up on, you know, we're used to it. I should say coffee is something that many of us grow up on and many of us are used to and depend on. Whether it's Starbucks or not, so everybody has their own personal taste. Some people like Starbucks, some people like 7-Eleven, some people like Dunkin' Donuts. Everybody has their own personal taste and preference. Some people, believe it or not, even drink instant still, you know, myself included. Some of us are just regular, plain old instant guys. But I think we're a dwindling bunch, especially with Keurig machines in everyone's kitchen. We're a dwindling bunch, but that does exist. I'm going to start with coffee, and I also find it's an interesting way to kind of springboard and talk about some more general kashrus topics and issues, which really thread throughout many kashrus discussions. So we'll talk about Starbucks, but we'll use it also as a springboard to talk about some bigger concepts that have repercussions in other areas, perhaps. The place to start when it comes to coffee is that coffee comes from coffee beans. Coffee beans grow from the ground. So pretty much anything that grows from the ground, certainly unadulterated, is going to be kosher. Obviously, when you get into the land of Israel, you have certain tricky things when it comes to trumos and maisros and shmita and things like that. But here in America, we certainly don't have any of those issues. So presumably, the safest things to consume are things that grow from the ground. Okay, we have to worry about infestation sometimes when it comes to certain types of vegetables, which are real issues. Maybe we'll probably talk about that as part of the series somewhere. Serious issues. But okay, infestation aside, insect infestation aside, you know, we can safely assume that things that grow from the ground are the most kosher. Technically speaking, you should be able to therefore walk into any establishment, whether it's a kosher establishment, not a kosher establishment, they sell kosher food, they don't sell kosher food, it shouldn't make a difference, and to buy plain, regular, unflavored coffee, right? And that is, I think, the mentality that most people walk around with, and it's not a wrong mentality. It's not a wrong mentality. But the tricky thing becomes when you start to get into the territory of things that are not just plain, unflavored coffee, and especially in 2016, the number of people who drink plain, unflavored coffee is dwindling, and everybody has their lattes and their macchiatos or whatever else they're called, and with all these other ingredients that are mixed into the coffee, that's where things get a little bit tricky, and that's where our conversation really, begins to get a little bit interesting. Yes? Haven't said anything yet.
Coffee, yeah. Does that apply equally to decaffeinated coffee?
Yeah, decaf and caffeine, yeah, it's the same thing. Yeah. In terms of the kashrus, it's the same. They don't do anything to the coffee that would alter the kashrus issue.
Don't they use certain chemicals to decaffeinate it?
I believe so, but I don't think there's anything that's really suspect. Oh, Pesach maybe. Yeah.
And the fact that the coffee might be washed with
tarfus. We'll come to that. Yeah, we'll come to that. That is a real issue. We'll come to that. Okay. So the first thing that you have to really question is that, let's say I walk into a Starbucks and I want to get not just a plain unflavored coffee, but I want to get one of the other, you know, fancier type drinks that they have there. So the first question you have to really deal with is, are all the ingredients that they're putting into this drink, are they all kosher? Now, if you have a store that's certified kosher by some reliable agency or reliable individual, so you don't have to worry about that. But your average Starbucks store, which is not certified by a reliable agency or individual, you know, you have to really question, make sure that everything that's going into the drink is kosher, in fact. And it turns out that at Starbucks, there's actually a list. I don't have I don't have it on me, the exact list. But much of this information that I'm sharing with you tonight comes from the CRC, which is the Chicago Rabbinical Council, who did a tremendous amount of research into Starbucks when this whole thing blew up. And there's a lengthy article, not only detailing all of the halachic considerations and implications that go into Starbucks and what goes into running the store, but just even practically. I mean, it's astounding the amount of detail that's in the article, just about how Starbucks stores are run and how they operate. I mean, there's so much research that went into this. And generally, because Starbucks is a chain, they might be independently owned, but they have certain protocol that are supposed to be followed throughout, and that's where things can be interesting. So not all ingredients that are served in a Starbucks store are kosher. Many of them are, but many of them are not. So you really have to be careful and make sure that the ingredients that are being mixed into these drinks are kosher ingredients. Nowadays, Baruch Hashem, we have a plethora of kosher ingredients, and every syrup and flavoring, not every, but many have OU. You could be on the side of the New Jersey Turnpike, and they have OUD coffee creamer, for your coffee that you buy in the rest stop. So that's great. Baruch Hashem, we have a great deal of that. But there are still some things out there that are not certified that people aren't aware of, and they just kind of think, what could be the problem with going into Starbucks and getting X, Y, or Z? But in fact, it's not that simple, and you really have to make sure that everything is certified. The list that I did have, that I have it, but it's in tiny little print, and even I can't read it. So I have to get a bigger copy of the list. Also, this list is a little bit outdated. The list has to be updated pretty regularly. But if you check these websites, the CRC has some information, the Star-K has some information about them. You should get at least some semblance of a list. It might not be updated to the minute because again, these agencies are not certifying Starbucks, so they don't. There's no impetus really for them to constantly stay updated. But they have some sort of list up there in terms of the ingredients. So that's number one. Now let's assume that all the ingredients that are being mixed into my drink are kosher. I'm only getting kosher ingredients. I checked, and I even I can look at the package and I see everything is OU. So all the ingredients that are being mixed in are totally fine, totally kosher. The question is then, what other problems could exist? Okay, so this is where we begin with some of the other problems. And the concept that we really have to begin with is a concept that we call nesinas tam. Okay, nesinas tam means transfer of taste. Now, we're all familiar with this idea, but we just have to explain the concept a little bit. Transfer of taste essentially means that anything that any kli, any vessel, any pot, pan, plate, cup, whatever the case might be, that I'm using with food, some of the taste, quote-unquote, right, we call it tam in Hebrew, I don't know if it's exactly taste, but some absorption, some level of absorption occurs that some particles of that food are absorbed into the material, at least from a halachic standpoint. Okay, I'm not sure scientifically if they have or have not experimented and decided that there are physical particles and absorptions that go into it or not. Sometimes there are, sometimes they're not. It might depend how porous the material that you're using is. But it doesn't really matter from a halachic perspective because the halacha wasn't talking about the science. They weren't referring to the science. They were referring to what they call nesinas tam. And therefore, from a halachic perspective, we assume that there's some level of tam that goes into this kli. And again, sometimes you can see it. When you use a chalon pot, you use it again and again and again. And if it starts out white, eventually it's going to turn brown where the chalon is. That might be some level of absorption. But even if you don't see that, even if it's a metal pot and you don't see anything, it doesn't really matter. You don't taste anything. It doesn't really make a difference in terms of this transfer of taste. Now, we do have a concept. Yes?
There also have to be some heat involved?
We'll get there, yeah.
From the scene as is just...
We'll get there. We're starting with the basics.
Okay.
Yeah, we're starting with the basics. Now, this Nesinas Tam, there is a concept called bittul. Bittul b'shishim, which means that sometimes, even if I have some transfer of taste, but Chazal gave us this system, I mean, the Torah in some regard, and the Rabbanan in other aspects, gave us this principle of bittul, which means that if I have enough heter, if I have enough permitted food, that corresponding to the prohibited food that came in, so it can nullify, the permitted food can nullify the prohibited food and can make it mutter. So for example, let's say I'm cooking a kosher dish, I'm cooking a kosher chalant, and a little bit of treif falls into my chalant, a little bit of treif, either I forgot it, I'm cooking it in a treif pot, somehow I got my hands on a treif pot, and I managed to cook my chalant in a treif pot, or I have a little bit of treif that falls in the pot, So we have to try to evaluate, do we have 60 times that treif in the pot to be mevatel or not? If I have 60 times, we have a concept of bitul b'shisha. If I don't have, then the bitul b'shisha will not work. If you look at the Shulchan Aruch in source number one, he really delineates and he explains this idea. Isur sheneisarev beheter min b'she'eno mino, v'cheinim hu min b'mino. I'm skipping some of the more complex parts of this seif, but basically, if I have something that's prohibited, that falls into, that gets mixed into something that's permitted, whether it's the same food item, whether it's a different food item, it doesn't really matter. Misharim b'shishim, we evaluate and we estimate, do we have 60 times the heter to the isur? Do we have 60 times the permitted food to the prohibited food, or do we not? If we have 60 times, it's batal. It's considered null and void, and it's not going to any way impact negatively the food that I'm cooking. If I don't have 60 times, then it will be a problem, and it will trafe up the food that I'm cooking. We do generally ascertain this in terms of volume. There's different ways of evaluating it. The Pesachei Tshuva writes in source number two that when we try to ascertain this 60, we do it not based on the weight. In terms of the weight of the item, but we do it based on the volume. So, assuming that you have 60 times the volume, that will be batal. Where it gets tricky is where you're talking about, let's say, the walls of a pot. You know, how much is contained in the walls of a pot? How much is contained in a spoon? So, we generally assume that the entirety of the pot is full of treif blios, is full of these treif absorptions, and that's all coming out into that kosher food that you're cooking, and therefore we really need 60 times the entire volume of the actual pot, which is usually hard to come by unless you have a very weirdly shaped pot. But assuming that you don't have that, that's the halacha of bittul. Now, as we just heard, transference of taste only happens through a very specific medium, okay, and that is hot liquid. If you look at source number three, the Shulchan Aruch says very clearly. In source number three, this is all in Yoredei and in Hilchos Taruvos. And again, I'm simplifying things a little bit just so that we can have a basic understanding without getting involved in all the complexities. But the Shulchan Aruch writes, "Nafal iser lesoch heter hakol aser." If I have an amount of iser that falls into the heter, assuming that you do not have 60 times the heter to the iser, that's going to prohibit everything. It's going to prohibit all of my food. Bamed dvarim aurim kishenafal lesoch hatavshil. We're talking about that the treif fell into my food, it fell into my chalent, it fell into my kosher dish. Why? The assumption is that the liquid that we're talking about is the medium through which these absorptions are traveling throughout. So the liquid is, so to speak, taking the absorptions out of the pot, bringing them into my food, or if some treif actually fell into my chalent, the liquid is taking those absorptions from that treif, from that tray food, taking that time and mixing it throughout my chalent is essentially what's happening from a halachic perspective. Now, it's not just that you need the medium of liquid, but that liquid has to be hot in order for there to be a transference of taste. How hot does it have to be? What we call yad soledes bo. Yad soledes bo literally means that a person's hand is scalded or burnt by this temperature. The Shulchan Aruch writes in source number four, Chom Shayat Soledespo Oser Kulo. Only that level, only that heat, only that temperature of Yad Soledespo will essentially create this transference of taste. Now, the question is, how do you ascertain Yad Soledespo? You should not take your hand and try to touch the pot or the food and to ascertain how hot, will it burn my hand or will it not burn my hand? That's not a good idea. That's not what Chazal had in mind. So what should you do? So you do have to estimate. You have to estimate. The Darkei Tshuva, interestingly, one of the poskim who wrote a great deal on Yoredeia, so he writes in source number five, and I'm sorry if it's a little bit unclear, but I think it's illegible. So he writes, skipping to the second line there, he writes, Shehamorim Noagim. He says he saw in a certain sefer, Shamorim noagim shim yecholin laochlo kach ve'ein tzarich linfoach al hamaachal sheyis karer zehu shir shein kreso sheltinok nichve. So he says one of the ways to ascertain this is the food hot enough that I cannot eat it without blowing on it to cool it down? Is it hot enough, so that I'm not going to be able to eat it without blowing on it to cool it down? If it's that hot that I have to blow on it to cool it down, that's going to be Yatso Ledesbo. But if it's not that hot, and I don't have to blow on it to cool it down, then that's not going to be Yatso Ledesbo. That's what he says, I saw at first people explaining this year. He quotes another way of expressing this year, but it's the same amount. The only problem is that we all know that everyone has different tolerances when it comes to heat, right? My wife likes, I've said this in the past, my wife likes soup piping hot, and I can't stand soup piping hot, it burns my tongue, right? So I like my soup to be a little bit cooler. She has a higher tolerance for heat, I have a lower tolerance for heat. So how can you give this type of a shiur that, depending on how hot it is, if I need to blow it down to cool it off or not, well, that all depends on the person and depends on the heat tolerance. Which is exactly what he writes at the end. He says, "Amnam hinei gam shir ze lo yadanu ki lav kol echad shava." Not everyone's the same, so it's very hard to figure that out. So Rav Moshe Feinstein was asked this question, and this tshuva is in the context of Shabbos, because when it comes to Hilchos Shabbos, Yad Soled Desbo is a very important shir when it comes to cooking on Shabbos, which we discussed back in the Vishul B'Shabbos Shiurim. But when it comes to transference of taste and kosher and treif, it also is very, very important. So this question was asked to Rav Moshe in source number 6, and he was asked, "Mahu shira chom sheish lachush bo lechumer liyatso ledesbo?" What is the measurement of temperature where we have to be concerned? We have to be machmir, be concerned that there's going to be some transference of taste, that some of this is going to transfer. So he writes, "Tshuva, meharoi lahachmir kimedumani b'shiur kuf yud, which is 110 degrees Fahrenheit." Which he writes is 43 degrees Celsius. Who kvar chom gadol sheyesh lachush liyad soledes kefimah shebadaknu be'atzmenu. So he writes, I did some experimentation. I don't know how he did the experiments, and I'm not asking, and I'm not suggesting that anyone else try this at home. But apparently Rav Moshe says that he experimented, he tried this out, and basing himself on different Mamari Chazal, which do describe this shiur and the amount of yad soledes po, so he ascertained that it's 110 degrees Fahrenheit. Now again, we're not walking around with thermometers, right, to figure out if something is 110 degrees Fahrenheit or not. We have to kind of estimate. You know, we have to kind of estimate. 110 is pretty hot. I think the average hot shower is around, like the high 90s, I think. I mean, our body temperature is 98.6, so I think like a warm hot shower is going to be 99, you know, maybe 100. I don't think you can get much hotter than that. Then it's really, really, it's really hot. So 110 is going to be, you know, significantly hotter than your hot shower. So you have to kind of, you know, figure out and ascertain how hot this item is. But, you know, that's one of the most important things. And whenever people call me with some sort of a kashrus shaila, so one of the first things I asked them was, well, how hot was it? And if you tell me that the item is cool, so we're in good shape. You know, if the soup was cool or something was cool when the thing went in, or it was just, I just took it out of the fridge, I just put it on the fire, but it was still cold. So that's pretty good. We're in good shape. We can deal with that. We can wash things off, and you know, we in most cases, not all cases, but in most cases, you know, it's not going to be a big kashrus concern. But when you start to get involved with hot things, especially when you're not sure how hot it was, you know, it was pretty hot, but I'm not sure how hot. So that's when things start to get a little bit tricky, and we get into this parsha of Yad Soled Despo. But the bottom line is that the only thing that the only type of medium that really transfers taste is liquid that is hot, that is Yad Soled Despo. That's also why, interestingly enough, if let's say, assuming I have two clean, dry pots, and one is milking and one is fleishig, and the two pots touch each other, so that would make people very nervous, right? Two pots touch, even if they're hot, you know? So, in truth, if they touch each other, and they're really clean and dry, then there's probably no transference of taste. Based on that. Now you have to be careful because sometimes, you know, I should say often, pots do get dirty, things overflow, and sometimes there is moisture there is some liquid. So you do have to be a little bit careful with that concept. But in, you know, theoretically at least, if something is really clean and it's dry, then even if it's hot, it's not going to transfer taste. You really need both of these things. You need hot liquid in order for this transference of taste to happen. Okay. So now let's move back to Starbucks for a minute. And this is where things get very interesting when it comes to Starbucks. Okay, so the reason why things get very interesting when it comes to Starbucks is because even if we assume that the drink that I'm getting is 100% kosher ingredients, right? I'm just getting coffee. There's nothing treif about coffee. It's unflavored. It's plain. It's regular. Nothing to worry about. There's really no kashrus concerns per se when it comes to the coffee. The only problem is that Starbucks, and I should just preface this by saying that there are two types of Starbucks establishments. There are some which are stores, full-service stores, and they serve, you go in there, you can get a hot treif sandwich, a hot turkey sandwich in many of the Starbucks stores. I'm not sure about all of them, but many of the Starbucks stores. And then there are, kind of kiosks that, you have sometimes in, let's say, a Barnes & Noble, or you might have in an airport, where they may not serve hot food. You have to you have to figure it out. They may not serve hot food. And, they might have some cake there. You can buy a cookie if you want. Or, they have those Rice Krispies treats, which I like, which are sometimes there. So, you might have those items, but you don't have any hot food. Nobody's heating up any hot turkey sandwiches or hot ham sandwiches for anybody in these kiosks. So the kiosks are pretty safe. Pretty safe. Yeah. I don't buy them there. I don't buy them there. I just like Rice Krispies treats. Personal anecdote, not halachic. Yeah.
Other than plain, unflavored coffee, if there's no hashgacha, and there's no mashgiach, and if they run out of waiting, you don't know if the $10 an hour employee is being told, etc.
Yeah, I mean, so yes. Now, let's assume. Let me just play devil's advocate for a minute. Let's say you ask the guy to see the package, and I want to see the syrup bottle, and very often they have the syrup bottles there. They just screw that top thing on, and I want to see which one you're squirting in, or I want to see the whipped cream bottle, So let's just play devil's advocate. Let's assume that you can verify the kosherness of all the ingredients, okay? So here's where we get to the problem. The problem really becomes in the Starbucks stores, the full-service stores, where they do serve hot tray food, okay? That's really where the problem lies. Now, I'm not ordering the hot tray food, so who cares? Right? Let me just go in and I'll get my macchiato, or I'll get whatever I want, and I'll walk out. So what's the problem? So the problem really comes when they wash the dishes. The problem really comes when they wash the dishes. This is where things get heated, really. Pun intended. Okay? This is where the things get interesting. Okay? Now, and this information I'm taking from the CRC article. Okay, the CRC did a lot of research into the Starbucks stores, and this is from the CRC article, and they describe the dish machine that's used in all Starbucks stores. They all use the same, pretty much, with maybe a few variations in terms of like the different models, but they pretty much all use the same, or very similar equipment. So the dish machine, at the end of the day, or after considerable use, utensils which are already clean are put into a machine that looks like a dishwasher for a two-minute sanitizing, okay? This is mostly in the stores. The dish machines have a two-part cycle. First, sanitizing solution is sprayed onto the dishes, and then fresh water is sprayed on to rinse the dishes. In most Starbucks stores, they use, and they quote the model here, I'm not going to read it to you, which accomplishes both of the aforementioned cycles with 180 degree Fahrenheit water. Certainly, Yatsa Ledesbo. We will see below that the use of this machine has a significant negative impact on the Blios, okay? Now, I should have really started with the sink. Before the dish machine, okay, they put the items in the sink. Okay, now let me just explain the sink for a minute. Just about all equipment gets washed in a three-compartment sink when it gets dirty. Okay, there's the general sink that they have in the Starbucks stores, or a three-compartment sink. At given intervals during the day, or at the thorough end of the day cleanup. In the three-compartment sink, the dishes first soak in hot, soapy water. That's sink number one. Then they are dipped into plain hot water or hosed down with plain hot water, which happens in sink number two. And then they are sanitized by being dipped into the ambient temperature water mixed with sanitizing solution in sink number three. Okay? So that's the way that they wash their dishes. They soak everything together in sink number one. Then they rinse everything off in sink number two. And they sanitize everything in sink number three. So here we can begin to see the problem, right? Because what's happening? You go to a store which sells hot treif food, okay? They're taking those dishes, those kalim, that they use for the hot treif food, and they take them and they throw them into the sink when they're done. The coffee pots, which they use for plain, unflavored, regular coffee, they're taking the coffee pots and they're throwing them into the same sink. Into the same sink, okay? Yeah.
For the hot coffee, don't they keep it in those giant urns that are plugged into the wall?
Don't they keep the coffee into the giant urns that are plugged into the wall? Okay.
They just put the beans on top, and then it,
I'm not sure. I'm honestly not sure. Yeah?
I don't know. Mm-hmm. I used to drink at Starbucks kind of stuff.
Right.
They put the beans on top and okay. it comes through.
Okay.
The coffee's filtered through in these like giant machines that they're probably not putting in a dishwasher because it's a
okay. So I'm not sure. It could be that some of this has changed. Okay, since that time, and you really have to check with the Starbucks and find out if they're using different machinery. At the time of the publishing of this article, which I don't have the year on me, but I think as of 2015, actually, I have a list here of 2015. So I think as of somewhat recently, at least most of the stores were using some sort, at least some part of that machinery was washed. I mean, nothing's washed. How do they clean it? They don't clean it? I don't know. They just run water through it?
I mean, I'm guessing.
Okay, I'm not sure.
Does it matter if the product is glass or metal?
The
assumption that glass is not bolea.
Right, glass is not bolea, but we still we don't use it lechatchila. No one would use glass for hot milchigs and hot fleishigs lechatchila, even if it's not bolea. You know, glass is different.
But hot tray on the other hand.
Would you use a hot tray glass plate? No, but we don't do that. We wouldn't do it lechatchila. So it might be that technically you're right. Glass is not bolea. But lechatchila, we certainly do not use hot treif things, even if they're glass.
Right.
You know. Okay. Now, things can change. Things can change, especially in stores, and things can change for the better. Some things can change for the worse. So that's why you do have to be a little bit on top of it. I'm not intimately familiar with the way that each Starbucks runs. I'm basing myself on the CRC's information. Things may have changed since that time. But I would imagine that even if they have machines that are stationary, I would imagine that there are some parts that are removable that are washed. I may be wrong, but I would imagine that's the case.
The assumption is that these parts are touching each other in the dishwasher? Is that the assumption?
No, even if they're not touching each other in the sink, but if they're all sitting there in the hot water together, right? If I have a treif kli, right? Okay? And I stick it into a hot sink with a kosher kli, my kosher kli is now treif.
How hot's the water?
Yatzalevisba.
The water is hot, yeah, so let us
we have to assume the water is hot. The water that they use to wash dishes is hot. So we have to assume, we don't know, I mean,
assuming,
you know.
To me it would be counterintuitive to have stick their hand into a yatzalevisba. But all right, that's the assumption.
That's the assumption. And I think, and again, when they did this research, I'm assuming that they measured, the temperature of the water. We're assuming that it's yatzalevisba, or at least lechumra, that we have to be concerned that there's a potential for yatzalevisba water. Okay? Yeah.
Are they putting their hands
That's the sanitizing.
We don't know that they're putting their hands in the sink. I mean,
we don't know that either. I don't know.
Yeah. There's spraying water on it and draining it.
They correct also, right? Off. Could be. Could be also. Yeah. Yeah.
But after they take it out of the sink, they then rinse it, and then later on they put them in the dishwasher.
Correct.
The dishwasher, therefore, in a sense, is ready. I think what most have it true, but that industrialized dishwashers are inherently koshering it off, because it's hargala in a sense. So now you're cashing that very same kli in the dishwasher.
Okay, I'm not sure. I'm not familiar with the tshuva. I'm not sure. I don't know. I have to look into that. I don't know.
I'm pretty sure. They say okay. Industrialized dishwashers, I think it's what also said, it's inherently to hargala. The question is, maybe you have to wait 24 hours to do it
I don't know. I'm not sure. I'm not ready to comment on that. I have to look into it. I'm not sure.
You must have mentioned that there's a dishwasher.
Well, they talk about this dish machine. They do not talk about Hagala regarding the dish machine. I don't know. I'm not sure about her motion. I'm not sure.
Why can't they mention the dishwasher gets so hot this to be
Hagala? I don't know. They say it's 180 degrees. I'm not familiar with the tshuva. I don't know. Maybe it exists. I'm not denying it exists, but I'm not familiar with it, so I don't want to comment on it. Okay.
I don't want to beat this up. I still have a problem with the sink.
Yeah.
I have a sink, right? I put in kosher and non-kosher.
Yeah.
And they're not touching.
Yeah.
So what's happening?
The hot water
is going into the water,
right?
And it's not bubbling in the water. Why not?
Well, it depends how much water is there. How much treif is there? It all depends. I mean, it is possible if I have a huge vat of water. Yeah, it is possible.
Even in the sink, there would have to be just a lot of leftover food in that utensil.
Not necessarily, because if the plate becomes treif, the whole plate is treif.
Good.
So all the bleos, that means the volume of that plate,
yes.
That amount of tarfos just went into the water. So you have to be mevatel. You have to be mevatel, can I get that amount of tarfos that's in the volume of that plate? That's a significant amount, right? So again, it is theoretically possible that you can have a big vat of water and the plate that goes in, it'll be mevatel it. But if you're throwing a whole bunch of dishes in, right, then the likelihood is pretty small, I think, that that will happen. Okay, now, there are a couple important things, and this is really where some of the heterim, that's right, I did say the word heterim, where some of the heterim come in here for this, to kind of save the day. And that is that there are different, when it comes to kashrus, Hilchos Shabbos also, but certainly when it comes to kashrus, there are different categories of utensils, different categories of vessels and utensils. And each of these categories has a slightly different halachic status. Okay? So for example, category number one is what we call Kli Rishon. Okay? Kli Rishon. Some of you are familiar when we learn Shabbos, you might be familiar with this from Hilchos Shabbos. So that's the category number one of Kli Rishon. Now the halacha is that when it comes to a Kli Rishon, okay, Kli Rishon is essentially the vessel or utensil or pot that is on the fire. Okay, that is on the fire, the heat source, the food, the water is being heated up directly in that pot. That pot, that vessel is called a Kli Rishon. Now the halacha is that a Kli Rishon, if you look at source number 7, Chom shel Kli Rishon shayatzel ledesbo, if I have a liquid in that Kli Rishon, which is yatzel ledesbo, mevashel ve'oser kulo, that is the worst. Right? If it's in a Kli Rishon, that's a disaster, and it's going to cook regarding Hilchos Shabbos, and it's also, and Basar B'chalav, excuse me, and it's going to and it's going to prohibit everything in there. So if I have a Kli Rishon, I have a pot, and this is where all the shilas of pots come in. I'm cooking with a pot, and now tray falls into that pot. That's a Kli Rishon. That's a big problem. Okay, if I have 60, okay, but if I don't, you're talking about a big problem here. Now, what if something is not a Kli Rishon? Okay, what if it's not a Kli Rishon? What if it's a Kli Sheni? What's a Kli Sheni? Kli Sheni is when I take that first utensil or vessel, and now I transfer the liquid, I transfer the food into another vessel, another utensil. So that is now called a Kli Sheni. What's the halach of a Kli Sheni? Does a Kli Sheni cook like a Kli Rishon, or does it not cook like a Kli Rishon? So if you look at source number 8, the Shulchan Aruch writes, Aval chom shel Kli Sheni. When it comes to a Kli Sheni, Yesh Omrim, Shegam kein eino maflit ve'eino mavliya. Some say that nothing transfers. In a Kli Sheni, there is no transference of taste. That's one opinion. V'yesh omrim, and we have another opinion, d'mikom ba'kom hu mafli tu mavliya ve'oser k'dei klipa. And others say that it does transfer taste. Now, it's not going to transfer taste to the same level that a Kli Rishon will. A Kli Rishon transfers taste into the entire Kli. Here, it's just going to transfer taste just to, let's say, the outer layer of that Kli. That's what we assume from a halachic perspective. Just the outermost layer of that Kli, the outermost layer of the food or the Kli, will be, quote-unquote, contaminated by those treif absorptions in the Kli Sheni. How do we paskin? We have a machlokas. We have two opinions. So what do we do? Write the Shulchan Aruch in source number 8. Ve'ro'i lachush li zaher bedavar lechatchila. Writes a Shulchan Aruch, lechatchila, you should try to be careful. Lechatchila, you should assume that a Kli Sheni is transferring taste, a Kedei Klipa. That's what we should assume. Aval b'diyeved mutter below Klipa u'behadacha ba'almasagi. But he writes b'diyeved, which means post facto, after the fact, if something happens and it's only a Kli Sheni, so then I don't have to assume that everything is treif, and I can assume that I just wash it off and it's okay. Okay, so here we have a little bit of room already in when it comes to Kli Sheni, that maybe we can have some sort of opening, some sort of Pesach maybe for a heter. There is also another category which is called a davar gush. A davar gush has nothing to do with Gush Etzion in Israel. Although when I first heard the term when I was young, that's what I thought. I thought it had to do with the yeshiva and gush, but I learned since then that it does not. But the term davar gush means that if I have a solid item like a piece of chicken, a piece of potato kugel, a sandwich that's hot, and I put it directly onto some sort of a kli, that might have the status of a kli rishon. Even if technically speaking it looks like a kli sheni, right? I cooked this piece of chicken in an aluminum pan, and now I take that chicken and I put it onto my plate. So presumably I would think the plate is now a kli sheni. And that's not where it was cooked. However, there is an opinion that says that a davar gush, if it's a solid, it's not a liquid, it's a solid item, so when I put that on, that gets the status of a kli rishon. Yes?
I think that's the problem of crock pots.
Of what?
Crock pots. Yeah.
Yeah.
Take the chillin' out and add ketchup. Right?
Yes, correct. Rav Moshe does have a chuba about that. That Rav Moshe I'm familiar with. Yeah, he has a chuba about that. Correct, yeah. He's maker with ketchup on a davar gush, but that's for Hilchos Shabbos.
You cook
Yeah, that's for Hilchos Shabbos. Yeah, I don't want to get into that now. Yeah, okay. So when it comes to a davar gush, what do we hold about a davar gush? So if you look at source number 9, the Shach writes, "The bedavar gush kigon basar v'chayotze bo." If I have something solid like meat or something similar to that, she'enot salul, which is not a liquid, ein chiluk ben kli rishon lekli sheni. There's no distinction between a kli rishon and a kli sheni. We assume everything is like a kli rishon and it prohibits. Aval kol zman shayatzel let us bo asur. So he does say the Shach is machmir that when it comes to a davar gush, we have a problem. We don't have to. We're running a little bit short on time, so we don't have time to get into the entire discussion of kli rishon and kli sheni. But suffice it to say that when we think about going back to Starbucks, when we think about Starbucks and what goes on in Starbucks, there are certainly kalim that are used in Starbucks that are considered kli rishon, right? They're used with hot liquid and they are used in the cooking process. So I'll give you an example. Again, this is information is taken from the CRC article, which did a lot of research into the Starbucks. Apparently, there, and I'm not a big Starbucks guy, so I really do not know this firsthand. But apparently, there are steaming wands in an espresso bar, and those things are a kli rishon. They're actually used to steam. Right, the wand is a metal rod, and it's used to steam something. It's used to heat something up, and it's hot, and that's used as a cooking device. That's a kli rishon. Obviously, the oven is a kli rishon. The oven that they have there. The ceramic oven plate, apparently what they do is that they actually heat things up directly on the ceramic plate. So they have a ceramic plate that they put into the oven. It's oven safe. They put it into the oven, and they heat things up directly onto that plate. That would make that plate a kli rishon. Knives, serving plates, things that are, again, when hot food is coming into contact with them, especially if you hold a davar gush, a solid sandwich or a piece of something, you know, it has the status of a kli rishon. As soon as you put it on that plate, that plate is going to have the status of a kli rishon, according to the Shach. The dish machine, the sink, we'll talk about in a minute. The dish machine might be what's called iroi kli rishon. Iroi kli rishon is when the liquid is poured or sprayed from a kli rishon. And the assumption when it comes to iroi kli rishon, if you look at source number 10, is that we hold lechumra. Va'anan says the Shach kaimelon lechumra. The iroi kli rishon mevashel kadei klipa. We assume that if something is poured or sprayed from a kli rishon, it does transfer taste at least into a kadei klipa. Again, at least into that outer layer of the item, and that would be the cause the problem when it comes to that. Now, one of the things, and just in conclusion, in the last few minutes. One of the things that might also be helpful for us is that there is a concept of no same tam lifgam. No same tam lifgam, at least in our application, without getting into all of the background of no same tam lifgam, but regarding our application of no same tam lifgam, what it means is that once these absorptions have been inside of a kli for 24 hours, once they've been sitting inside the kli for 24 hours, and the kli, this utensil, has not been used in 24 hours for anything hot, okay, you know, if you filled it up with cold water, that's fine. We're talking about it hasn't been cooked with. You haven't used it for anything hot in 24 hours. So those absorptions, those blios, have the status of no sein tam lifgam. Okay, no sein tam lifgam. We don't use it lechatchila. We don't use it, ideally. But b'di'evit, if something happened, then there is room to be lenient with no sein tam lifgam. One of the other methods of no sein tam lifgam, the Shulchan Aruch writes this, is that if you have soap, soap can actually make water into no Saint Tom Lifgam. Why? Because soap is very not tasty. Soap is very not tasty. It ruins the taste of things. So therefore, if I have soapy water, it will ruin the taste of the of whatever blios are coming in here. Okay, so that's something that we have to keep in mind also. Now, let's think about the sink for a minute. Okay, the sink has again three compartments. So the first compartment in that sink is full of hot soapy water, and the dishes are placed into that hot soapy water. Now, at the outset, it sounded pretty bad, right? Because we have these treif dishes and the kosher dishes all being mixed together into this hot sink, of water. The only thing is, we have two considerations which might permit these dishes. Consideration number one is that the sink is probably only a cliché. Why? Or certainly only a cliché. Because the sink, the water is not being heated up in the sink. The sink is not a pot. Right? The water is not being heated up in the sink. The water is being heated up in some hot water tank, and then it's being transported through the pipes into that sink. So the sink is going to be a cliche. Now, if the sink has soap in it, which the first compartment does, then also you have the consideration of no Saint Tam Lifgam, because that soap makes all of the water distasteful, and therefore any treif absorptions that are coming out into that water essentially lose their good taste and now are not really good tasting. So really the first sink is not terrible, the first compartment. The second compartment is a little trickier. Okay, the second compartment is a little trickier. Because in the second compartment, all the dishes are taken out of the first compartment, okay? And now they are washed off or rinsed off in hot water in that second compartment. Now here's where things can get a little bit tricky. Why? Because we're talking about hot water, okay? The hot water here is going to be considered Iroi Kli Rishon, because it's coming out of the sink or out of the hose, whatever they're using. So that's pouring out of, it's coming directly from the hot water heater, which is the Kli Rishon. So that's Iroi Kli Rishon that's coming onto those dishes. And very often at that stage, the soap is no longer on the dishes, right? The soap is now being rinsed off. So here you have Iroi Kli Rishon, which we try to be machmir, that it does prohibit at least the outer layer of the kli, makes, you know, that kdei klipa makes it problematic, and you don't have the soap. So here's really where the problem lies, in that second compartment. Because here you could have the treif dishes and the kosher dishes, and now the hot water is now being sprayed over all of those dishes, and you have hot water hitting treif dishes, going to the kosher dishes, and here's where you have a problem. Now, there are still some considerations which might mitigate this concern. Number one, you could argue that maybe there's still some soap there. Maybe the soap is still on the dishes, and therefore maybe even though the hot water is hitting, but maybe it's not going to be such a big deal because you do have that soap in the same time they've got. You could also argue that maybe if it's only Iroi Kli Rishon, it's only prohibiting the outer layer of the dishes, so maybe you might have bittel. You might have 60 times, you know, in the water, you might have 60 times the outer layer of those dishes, kidei klipa. Also, not all dishes are washed simultaneously, so you could maybe have that consideration as well. And then also, by the time it gets to your drink, you know, whatever small amount also might be batel at that point. Okay? So those are some of the considerations that mitigate some of the kashrus concerns. Now, and with this we'll conclude, because I know it's getting late. So in reality, so what do we say? Right? How do we come out at the end of the day? So at the end of the day, most kashrus agencies, if you ask around, most kashrus agencies advise you to be machmir. Okay? Advise you to be machmir. Why? Because you do have this second sink, and you have the problem of the Iroi Kli Rishon with the treif dishes in the middle and the kosher dishes together, and there's presumably not that much soap left by the time that they're being rinsed off in that second sink, and that's really where the problem lies. Since we did mention some mitigating factors, there are poskim who are makil, there are poskim who permit a person to rely on these things. First of all, you know, Iroi Kli Rishon might only be lechatchila. There are certain poskim who are makil based on some of these considerations, but the general, you know, approach is that one should try to be machmir. So again, I know some people live and die on Starbucks. So then there's, you know, I guess those people will have to rely on the mekilu. But if you ask me my opinion, or if you want to ask the opinion of, let's say, the CRC or the Star K, very often they will tell you that it's better not to purchase things at the big Starbucks stores where they are serving and heating up treif hot things. Because again, you have this problem with the dishes. The kiosks are okay. Any place where they're not serving hot food is going to be okay. But any place where they're serving hot treif food could be problematic. The one saving grace here also is that the Star King, which is under Rav Heinemann, does hold that when a person is traveling, when they're not at home, they have the right to rely on some of these kulas. And therefore, assuming that whatever drink that they're getting is kosher and free of any concerns, they can rely on some of the kulas if they're traveling. So if you're away, you're on business, you're in the airport or something like that, and you know you need a coffee, and this is the only place where you can get a coffee, and you don't have to worry, so then some of them, Rav Heinemann is makil, because we do have some considerations to allow a person to be makil. He's makil if a person is traveling. You can take these principles and pretty much apply them to any scenario. So if you go to a Dunkin' Donuts, you know, or you go to a 7-Eleven, you can apply them the same way. I remember I walked into the 7-Eleven here and started interrogating the guy to ask him how he washes the coffee pots, because they do serve hot food there. And he was very careful. He told me, he said, "We wash them separately. Don't worry. We're very concerned with the Jewish laws." So obviously, I wasn't the first person who broached this issue with him, but he told me very clearly that they were washed separately. And I imagine that's the case if people are concerned about it. But that's pretty much the bottom line. Any further questions? Feel free to ask or to contact me. But yeah.
If you go, let's say you're a hotel or whatever it is,
right. Right. Baruch Tia, thank you for coming.